Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Marion Mulkey, Director of Health Reform and Public Programs for the California Healthcare Foundation, and your chair for tonight's program. Today's program is underwritten by the California Healthcare Foundation. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the Internet at commonwealthclub.org and the foundation at chcf.org. Today's discussion will focus on the Supreme Court's decision to uphold the majority of President Obama's health reform plan, including the requirement that individuals obtain coverage. That requirement means that beginning in 2014, people will need to get coverage by enrolling in a public program such as Medi-Cal, California's version of Medicaid, if they're eligible, by enrolling in employer-sponsored coverage, if they have that option, or by purchasing coverage directly or through the soon-to-be-established California Health Benefit Exchange. Those who don't obtain coverage, unless they qualify for affordability exemptions, will face a penalty, or some people, including Chief Justice Roberts, might refer to it as a tax. The court's decision has important implications for California and Californians, and we have a terrific panel here tonight to help explain those implications. For example, how will this landmark ruling affect your health coverage and medical care? What does it mean for businesses and for healthcare providers? Of great relevance, given Californians' ongoing state budget woes, how will the decision affect federal funds flowing into California and the California state budget? And finally, as we move toward full implementation of the law in 2014 and beyond, what are remaining areas of uncertainty and important milestones to watch that could indicate progress? Our distinguished panel of healthcare insiders and advocates will dissect the Supreme Court's decision, including its impact on providers, patients, and the state's more than 7 million uninsured. To introduce our panel and begin the discussion, it's now my pleasure to turn the program over to Lisa Alaferas, health editor for KQED News.
Thank you, Ms. Mulkey, and thank you, everyone, for joining us this evening. I want to remind people that in addition to what Marion Mulkey just explained about the Affordable Care Act, California has been very aggressive in implementing many phases of the Affordable Care Act in looking toward the 2014 deadline. And there are several aspects of the Affordable Care Act already in place which are helping tens of thousands of these 7 million uninsured Californians. That includes young adults who can stay on their parents' plan until age 26. There are no more exclusions for health insurance for people with pre-existing conditions, and lifetime caps on benefits have been eliminated. The linchpins of the plan, the health insurance exchange, and the Medicaid expansion were all now driving toward the January 1st, 2014 deadline. So there's tremendous renewed public interest now that the Supreme Court has ruled, as we can see. So I'd like to introduce our panel. First, Peter Lee. He is the first executive director of the California Health Benefit Exchange. That's a post he's held since October 2011. Following the passage of the federal health care reform in 2010, California was the first state to create a health benefit exchange as required by the law. The exchange is charged with creating a new insurance marketplace in which individuals and small businesses will be able to purchase competitively priced plans using federal tax subsidies and credits, and that is by January 2014. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Lee. Next, we have Larry Levitt. He is Vice President of Special Projects for the Kaiser Family Foundation. The Kaiser Family Foundation is a leader in independent health policy analysis and health communication. The nonpartisan Kaiser Family Foundation is not affiliated with Kaiser Permanente. Next, we have Bill Kramer. Mr. Kramer is the Executive Director for National Health Policy for the Pacific Business Group on Health. The Pacific Business Group on Health is a nonprofit coalition of large businesses which focuses on cost, quality, and affordability of health care. And finally, we have Anthony Wright. Mr. Wright is with Health Access, a statewide health care consumer advocacy coalition. He has been its executive director since 2002. Health Access has been a leader in efforts to fight health care budget cuts, win consumer protections, and advance comprehensive health reform and coverage expansions. Thank you very much, all of you, for joining us. So the first question goes to Peter Lee. Mr. Lee, the ACA does go into full effect on January 1st, 2014, when these millions of uninsured Californians will enroll in coverage. Half of those uninsured are expected to access insurance through the new exchange. How is the exchange going to work, and how are you going to meet this daunting and somewhat looming deadline?
Well, thank you very much, Lisa. I guess the first thing I'd note is the Affordable Care Act is not just about the 7 million uninsured in California, but it's about making the healthcare system work for all Californians. And I think we need to understand the context of the exchange, and that context is that come January 2014, every single Californian knows for the first time in history they have health insurance security for the rest of their life. They will be guaranteed all to be able to buy health insurance. That's something Californians don't have today. Also, the rules of the game change for all insurance companies. Come January 1, 2014, the game of insurance is no longer about avoiding sick people. It's about actually providing better high-quality care at a lower cost. The exchange is part of expanding coverage to about 5 million of the uninsured Californians through two ways. One is helping people find out if they're eligible for Medicaid. Medi-Cal in California, you'll hear more about that. That's about 2 million. About 3 million Californians, though, people that earn right now anywhere from $15,000 up to $93,000 a year that can't afford insurance will be given help to buy insurance through the exchange. They'll be given a credit that's going to be in the form of a check that's sent directly to the private health plan they choose through the exchange. And what we're going to do is create a marketplace and make it able make a way for consumers to pick the plan that's right for them. And we're going to be doing that in the next year by doing marketing, because there's been a lot of disinformation about the Affordable Care Act. We're going to be in schools, in churches, in communities, educating people about these new benefits. We're going to be helping people enroll, and we're going to be putting together a slate of products that will be something that we think will be things that Californians are going to want to buy. We think we will have literally millions of Californians who are buying insurance, not because of a mandate, which is somewhat of a canard as of an issue. The 7 million Californians that don't have insurance don't have it, not because there's not a mandate, because they can't afford it. We need to make health care affordable, and that's what we'll be doing with the exchange.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Lee. Next is Larry Levitt from the Kaiser Family Foundation. Now, we do want to focus on California in this hour, but California can't go it alone. A handful of governors have already said that they won't implement the Medicaid expansion. How does that impact, refusal to go along with the Medicaid expansion impact the implementation and the ultimate success of the Affordable Care Act and efforts to reduce the number of uninsured?
Well, thanks, Lisa. You know, maybe a surprise to Peter, but in fact, healthcare reform has been pretty non-controversial here in California to the way it's been in the rest of the country. And the public has been divided on this law from the very start, and they continue to be divided. Frankly, after the Supreme Court decision, they're a little more positive than they were before, but one can hardly call them positive. So in many states around the country, governors have been waiting on the sidelines and deciding how they want to approach this law. They were waiting until the Supreme Court decided to let the law go ahead. Once the Supreme Court decided that, they're still waiting on the sidelines, waiting until the outcome of the November election, with the hope among some that the law, in fact, will be repealed. As you think about this law, and Peter alluded to this, it's really a two-pronged approach to getting people insurance. The first is for middle-class families. There's the exchange that Peter's working hard to get set up, and the changing of the rules of the game, that insurers are prohibited from discriminating against people with pre-existing conditions. Anyone can get insurance through this exchange if they don't have it elsewhere, and there are these federal tax credits available to a substantial number of people to help them buy insurance. In fact, the tax credits are available to families making up to $90,000 a year or more in some cases. And the hope is that many states like California will move forward and set up these exchanges and enforce these rules on insurers. But if states don't do that, if governors and legislatures decide not to do that, then the federal government will step in and do it for them, as the case may be. The second prong in how people get coverage is for low-income families. And for them, Medicaid gets expanded to cover all people at or near the federal poverty level. And here the Supreme Court really threw everyone a curveball. The court said that the law as a whole could go into effect, but this expansion in Medicaid for low-income families would be optional for states. California has actually already started to implement this, but there are a handful of governors around the country that are saying that they're not going to do it. And it's optional, but it's in fact a very good deal for states. The federal government will initially pay 100% of the cost of this Medicaid expansion for low-income families, and over time that phases down to 90% of the cost. So, in effect, states can expand coverage to low-income people in their state for 10 cents on the dollar. I'm sure we'd all love to be able to buy gas at that price. But states don't have to do it, and unlike the exchange and the insurance market rules, the federal government will not and cannot step in to make that happen. So, to the extent governors resist, and I think there may be a handful of governors that will, it won't stop implementation in its tracks. Everything else will still go into effect, but the poorest of the uninsured in those states simply won't get access to affordable insurance.
Okay, thank you very much. Next is Bill Kramer from the Pacific Business Group on Health. Mr. Kramer, the key elements, as we've been hearing, of the ACA are about expanding access to the uninsured and the individual market and also small employers. But your organization represents a lot of large employers in California. How are they reacting to the ACA, and what changes does the law bring for people who already get their insurance at work?
Thanks, Lisa. You're absolutely right. The primary purpose of the Affordable Care Act was to expand coverage to the uninsured and to reform the insurance markets, especially for individuals and small employers. As a result, the impact of the Affordable Care Act on large employers and their employees is relatively modest, at least in the short and medium term. This is good news and bad news at the same time. The good news is, as we all know, most large employers offer good, affordable, comprehensive coverage to their active full-time employees, and I don't think we'd want to disrupt that. There have been a number of requirements in the early years of the Affordable Care Act that large employers have had to comply with or demonstrate compliance with, such as expansion of coverage for dependents up to age 26, coverage of preventive services, a standardized statement of benefits and coverage. Those are relatively modest. Some employers have complained that it's a bit of administrative hassle, but in the grand scheme, compared to the other changes in the Affordable Care Act, these are relatively modest. In 2014, things become a little more serious with the establishment of the employer responsibility requirements, and then in 2018, with the advent of what's the so-called Cadillac tax, which is an excise tax on very high-cost employee benefit plans. But the bad news is, out of all this, is that regardless of how large employers felt about the Affordable Care Act, pro or con, on the day after the Supreme Court decision, they still woke up with the same problem they've been facing for the past year, for the past decade, which is that costs are too high. And rising costs are a threat not only to the future of employer-sponsored coverage, but actually to the Affordable Care Act itself, particularly the expansion of coverage that is so important. The Affordable Care Act does include a number of elements which set us in the right direction that we think over time may have an impact on costs, changes in payments under Medicare to reward value, not just volume, demonstrations and new programs like the Accountable Care Organizations, Primary Care Medical Homes, new pilots such as bundled payments. But most employers and many healthcare experts feel that while these are headed in the right direction, by themselves, they probably won't make the kind of dent in the healthcare spending trends that we need. So the bottom line of all this is that cost containment is the next chapter of healthcare reform. We need to do that not only to shore up the employer-based system, but to also preserve the gains of the Affordable Care Act.
All right, thank you very much. And Anthony Wright, the final question goes to you. Anthony Wright from Health Access. Now, California is, as we've been hearing, moving ahead with the Medicaid expansion. Now, from the consumer perspective, give us a quick overview of what needs to be in place to make sure the millions of uninsured in California smoothly access health insurance, either through the exchange or through Medicaid expansion.
Thank you. The first thing that needed to be in place was a good Supreme Court decision. And we got that. And that's especially important here in California. No state in the nation had more at stake with what the Supreme Court decided than California. Not only because we have one of the greatest severity of the problem, Californians are more likely to be uninsured, more likely not to get coverage at work, more likely not to be able to afford coverage, more likely to be denied for pre-existing conditions than residents of all but a handful of states. But no state in the nation, bar none, has been as aggressive in taking advantage of the new benefits, the new options, the new funds, the new opportunities to address those problems under the Affordable Care Act. Very excitingly, there are people who now have coverage now that, as because of the Affordable Care Act, 12,000 people who were denied for pre-existing conditions now have coverage through a pre-existing condition insurance program. If the Supreme Court had ruled the other way, those 12,000 Californians would have been left uninsured and uninsurable in our individual market. More excitingly, we have over 400,000 Californians who are now getting coverage through the Medicaid expansion, an early part of the Medicaid expansion where we're drawing down federal funds. Counties have stepped up to take some of their dollars that they put to medically indigent care to draw down federal funds to start the expansion early. This is a very exciting prospect. Low-income people are now getting coverage that they didn't before. Over 47 counties are already moving ahead with that, and we think most of the others will in the next few months. But again, the real promise for coverage expansion is in 2014, where millions of people will newly be eligible. But then the question is, are we going to have the infrastructure, the systems in place to get all those folks into coverage? I would like to make the case that this is not just important to get millions of people enrolled on day one, January 1, 2014. It is imperative. Number one, we want people to get coverage. For people who are uninsured live sicker, die younger, and are one emergency or illness away from financial ruin. We have the tools in place to deal with that issue directly. Number two, for every day we do not enroll people in coverage and get people coverage, that is millions, if not billions, of dollars that we're leaving in Washington, D.C., and not coming into our healthcare system and our economy, because for the exchange and for Medi-Cal, those are 100% federally funded folks, but only if we enroll people. So that's really important as an economic stimulus, if anything else. But third, the thing is we need this to be a big and broad pool, because if it's a small and sick pool, it will be the costs will be higher. The people who sign up the quickest will be the sickest because they need it most. And that's a good thing. We want those people to get care, but we need everybody to participate, because then the risk and the cost will be spread and the prices will be lower. So we want to embark on the day one challenge. How do we get millions of people enrolled in coverage so that this can work the best for California, for not just the people who are uninsured, but the people who are insured and want to have a lower rate and want to have a better and healthier healthcare system?
Okay, so Peter Lee, that comes in part right back to you, because you need to enroll these millions of people. Half of them will be coming through the exchange. How is that infrastructure going to be built and going to be ready?
A couple things. I really couldn't agree more with Anthony that we need to get everyone in. And part of changing the rules of the game in health insurance is to say it isn't about the risk avoidance business and avoiding sick people. It's about getting everyone in. And that's what the Affordable Care Act does. At the exchange, we're doing three things to make sure that this works for Californians. First, we're going to have, again, affordable private plans that people can choose. And you hear a lot of this sort of a hyperbole of government takeover of healthcare. This is the furthest thing you can get from a government takeover of healthcare. We're giving people the ability to choose the right plan for them with federal support to make it affordable. So we're going to have products that people want to buy. Number two, we will be doing outreach. There has been so much confusion, misinformation, disinformation. People have no idea of what the benefits are under the Affordable Care Act. So we'll be reaching out in schools, in churches, where people play. We're going to be working with sports teams. We're going to be doing an advertising campaign. But importantly, we'll be in communities. People will be confused, and we'll be having literally tens of thousands of people coming from counties, from consumer groups, one-on-one, sitting across from the table from people saying, here's how you can enroll, here's how you can get a plan that works for you. Third, we're going to have an online system that people can enroll in. And I've said a number of times, we hope to make enrolling in healthcare as easy as buying a book on Amazon. Now, it's going to be a complicated book. Okay, it's not going to be that easy. Okay, but at the same time, it's going to be something that, and I think Anthony's point is really important, is that if you're sick, if you've got diabetes, you'll stay on the phone that extra 20 minutes, that extra half hour, that hour. If you're one of those young invincibles, that 25-year-old that thinks, you know, I don't really want to buy insurance, if we don't make it easy, every little bit of friction means maybe they'll drop off the phone. Maybe they won't click to enroll. We need to make it seamless, easy, so everyone's going to enroll as easy as possible.
So, but we have a question from the audience about what are the benefits? And I think this actually connects to Bill Kramer from the Pacific Business Group on Health, because how much accessing insurance through the exchange is going to be similar to what people who work for a large employer, I mean, is this the kind of thing we can expect that if I work for a large employer and I have a range of plans to choose from? But if it's, I'm at a large employer, it's usually not comparing apples to apples. So how does...
Actually, it's going to be very, very similar to working for a large employer. And a couple of things are changing with the Affordable Care Act. First, right now, many of us, whether we work for a large employer or buy an insurance on your own, it's often hard to know what you're actually getting. One of the things the Affordable Care Act does is saying everyone, large employer, small employer, individual, should make sure they're getting what are called essential health benefits covered. That's going to be a standard across the entire market, not just in the exchange.
And second, when will those benefits, when can we see what those benefits will be?
Those benefits are actually under discussion right now in the state legislature. The guardrails are being framed by the federal law, the Affordable Care Act, that says here's 10 categories, preventive services, acute care, mental health care, that are already, you know, framed by the Affordable Care Act. California, though, gets to pick specifically how do we shape that in California, and that's under discussion right now in the state legislature. But it will take effect in January 2014. And so what people will be buying in the exchange is the same products, the same rich benefits, or less rich if they don't want to pay as much, as people will get in large employers or small employers. So the range of benefits is going to be not second-class care or second-class coverage, but first-class coverage.
I would say, I mean, it's not for me to say that Supreme Court justices might be confused sometimes, but if you read the transcript of the Supreme Court oral arguments, there were a number of justices who talked about, you know, this requirement to buy coverage and people requiring to buy a Cadillac plan, a generous insurance plan, and those will certainly be available. And the insurance out there will have certain minimum benefits that you would expect from insurance, drug coverage, maternity coverage, which is often not the case now. But as Peter said, there is a range of deductibles that people will be able to choose from. And in fact, the lowest plan, what the law calls a bronze plan, and will be a very high deductible plan. So if that's what people want, that will certainly be available.
Go ahead.
Just a comment on the linkage between large employer benefits and what will be available in the exchange. The exchange doesn't have to start from scratch and decide how it's going to do this. Large employers may not have been perfect over the years in how they design and develop health benefit plans for their employees, but there's some good lessons that have been learned about what works and what doesn't work. How do you choose what's a good health plan? How do you choose a health plan that offers a good provider network that provides access to all the employees? How do you make sure information is available to employees, consumers, so they can compare the plans, how they can compare physicians, how they can compare hospitals? There are lessons that have been learned, standards that have been developed, tools that have been used that can be adapted by the exchange for its own particular needs. And I give Peter and the exchange board a lot of credit for looking for existing performance standards, quality measurement, and consumer tools that can be used and adapted and built upon as they design and develop the exchange.
I think one of the big benefits of the law that's overlooked is not just the new security and the new expansions of coverage, but the consumer protections that are newly available to people. This is really a federal patient's bill of rights for everybody. First of all, regulation of insurance has traditionally been at the state level, so this finally puts a federal cop on the beat, if you will. But another thing that I think is really important is providing some more security that your coverage will be there for you when you need it, that you don't have the fear of the fine print that what you actually come down with is actually not covered, that there is a floor of what the benefits are, and that you truly understand what your coverage is and what's included and what's not included and what the cost sharing is, et cetera, by having and allowing, for example, these apples-to-apples comparisons. If anybody tries to buy individual coverage right now, you know how insanely complex and confusing it is. I think that's a reason why some people just finally don't get coverage, because it's just so maddening and crazy-making. And that's why I think this idea of the exchange as a place where it's the HR department for the rest of us, to do it, and it's not just in providing it being a good housekeeping seal of approval for the plans that are in. It also is using the bulk purchasing power of the exchange to bargain for the best possible value and price. This is something that California is doing. Not every state is doing is using that power, but that's, I think, a really important thing that we're going to do in California. We're going to have a couple of million people in there, and that will have a much better ability to negotiate for the best value than you or I could do as individuals. If you go to Anthem Blue Cross right now and say, I want a better offer, you might not get as good a response. But but Peter, with a couple of million people that he's representing, might be able to, A, standardize products so you can do those apples-to-apples comparisons, but B, say, we want to drive the market in terms of value, in terms of price, in terms of just making sure that it's a quality package.
Now, on the flip side, the majority of Californians do have health insurance, and I have several questions from the audience. If I have Kaiser, how will I be affected? If I have Medicare, how will I be affected? So, and Larry Levitt, do you want to, from the Kaiser Family Foundation, can you address that?
Sure. I won't address all circumstances of everyone in the audience, but it's, for the most part, people who have insurance now can keep that insurance. It's not going away. As Peter said, there's no federal takeover of the healthcare system. But as Anthony said, there are some protections that go into place for people who already have insurance. We talked earlier about people being able to keep their kids on their policy up to age 26. Policies can no longer have lifetime limits, which may happen today. They have to cover these essential benefits, drugs, maternity care, hospital care, physician care, et cetera. And most importantly, I think, that the coverage can't be denied. If you've got coverage, it's guaranteed renewable. You can always keep that coverage. And if you want to switch, and this is important. I mean, right now when people, if you have a pre-existing condition and you have coverage, you're sort of stuck in that coverage. You may even be stuck in a job because you're worried about losing that coverage. With these protections that go into effect in 2014, you always have the option of leaving a job or shopping around for a better deal with insurers.
I wanted to pivot a little bit now and talk about cost, because there's the issue of cost of health insurance, which I think that people have somewhat of a misperception that because that the Affordable Care Act will somehow be able to roll back insurance prices. And then the flip side is, so there's cost of health insurance. There's also healthcare costs themselves. Bill Kramer, as you mentioned, costs as a driver of health and healthcare costs contribute to the rising cost of health insurance. And how important is it that moving forward we look at, and what does the Affordable Care Act do to address increase in quality and decrease in costs?
Let's start with a few facts. Healthcare costs in the United States are much too high. They're much higher than any other industrialized country, and we don't get the quality, the outcomes that other countries do. It's estimated that the waste in our healthcare system is around 30%. That's unnecessary care. Services that are being provided that do not help people get better, and in some cases are harmful. This is a widely accepted fact, not just among health policy wonks, but among physicians, hospital leaders, and so on. We have a great opportunity to reduce costs and do it in a way that actually improves quality, because some of that unnecessary care actually creates harm. The Affordable Care Act makes some steps in the right direction to reduce some of that waste and improve the affordability of health care. I mentioned a few of them earlier. For one change would be under Medicare. Currently, physicians and hospitals are paid largely based on the volume of services they provide. The more office visits, the more hospital admissions, the more tests that are done, the more payments are made, and the more revenue goes up. That leads to an incentive for unnecessary care. A lot of it's necessary, but there's some that's unnecessary. Under the Affordable Care Act and other legislation, the payment mechanisms under Medicare are beginning to change so that there will be rewards to physicians and hospitals and other providers that are doing the right thing by providing safer care, better care, and more efficient care for their patients.
Isn't there the risk, though, that people hear this more efficient care as meaning denial of care?
Well, as I said, if it's done poorly, if there are not quality standards, if there's not oversight for patient safety and quality outcomes, yes, there's a risk. That's why any kind of cost containment measures need to be coupled with a good measurement of the quality of care that's being provided to assure that that kind of stinting of care or reduction of necessary care does not happen.
And I really want to build on this, because I think that the point that Bill made is really important, that we have an affordability crisis. It's an affordability crisis for America's families, for business, but also for government. The main problem with the federal deficit is Medicare spending. If we don't get our arms around generally having our spending get better quality, we're going to have a collapsed economy. And the issues of what the exchange can do, we're going to be big, we're going to be a very large purchaser, but we're not big enough alone. Medicare's not big enough alone. Private purchasers aren't big enough alone. We need to be together saying, let's not pay for a treadmill of doing more being rewarded, but let's instead pay for better quality. And I'll give you one example of that, of what Medicare is doing, is coming up now, hospitals will be rewarded and paid more if they reduce the number of people that are harmed by that hospital. Well, that's a good thing. You know, tens of thousands of Californians are injured every week by hospital-acquired infections. And it's not because hospitals want to do this. We have the best nurses, best doctors in the world, but we have systems that aren't working. But all of a sudden, hospitals are saying, I think I'll invest in actually making sure we don't have pressure ulcers in this hospital. I'm going to invest in reducing central line infections instead of putting in a new cardiac wing because there's a financial reason to do it. And we need to change the incentives. The exchange can be part of that, but we need to be working with other purchasers.
Anthony Wright from Health Access.
And my organization was the organization that sponsored the right to go for a second opinion if your HMO denies you for medically necessary care. I will challenge anybody about who's more of an advocate about being against denials for medically necessary care. At the same time, I don't know a single consumer that I've met who wants to take more drugs than they really need to, who wants to spend more time in an emergency room than they really need to, who wants to spend more time in a hospital than they need to. That, you know, in fact, we think that there are ways to control costs in the healthcare system that are actually that improve quality rather than it's not all about just denying for medically necessary care. It's about having the right systems in place so that people get the right care at the right time, in a timely way, so that people don't, for example, go to the emergency room when they could have had just an appointment with a doctor if they just got it in a timely way. It's those kinds of changes to our system that are important. I do want to just go into how people experience this because you're right. There are some people who either get coverage through their work or who even pay coverage out of pocket may not see a big difference in their costs, although hopefully some of the changes and reforms that Bill talked about will come to fruition, some of the investments in prevention and information technology and other pieces. But there are some people who will get discounts and help immediately. Already, there are small businesses who are getting a tax credit to help cover their workers. There are seniors, over 300,000 seniors in California, who are getting help at their prescription drug costs in the closing of the donut hole. In 2014, as said, people will get subsidies in the exchange that are worth hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars to help better afford coverage. That includes about 1 million people in the individual market now who are paying 15, 20, 25% of their incomes for coverage, who will now get some help to meet those bills. So there's going to be some real relief for a lot of people And there's more gradual relief for the rest of us as hopefully some of these cost containment measures kick in.
The other piece I want to come back to, I keep on talking about changing the rules of the game, is insurance companies are now going to be required to spend the vast majority of the dollars they collect on health care. And if they don't, what do? They have to give it back to consumers. In California, this year, 1.9 million Californians are going to get a check from their insurance company because their insurance company didn't spend enough on health care.
Aren't those checks going out this summer? Are they going
out
right now?
That's going out this summer. They're in the process of going out.
Has anyone received a check? I'm just curious.
We got a number of hands here, of hands that have gone up.
$4. $4.
Well, I'll tell you, the insurance companies are not going to let that happen again because they're going to say, we're going to make sure we spend the money on health care, which is where we want it spent.
I think we should.
So we don't want to have rebate checks going out. We want money going to doctors, nurses, and to health care being provided.
Okay. We should also point out that California already was, it's called the medical loss ratio. California insurers were already overwhelmingly paying the 80% to 85% inpatient care that they were supposed to be. I want to pause for a moment now and just for our radio listeners. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today's discussion focuses on the impact of the Supreme Court's decision regarding the Affordable Care Act, specifically as related to California. Our panelists are Peter Lee, Executive Director of the California Health Benefit Exchange, Larry Levitt, Vice President of Special Projects at the Kaiser Family Foundation, Bill Kramer, Executive Director for National Health Policy at the Pacific Business Group on Health, and Anthony Wright, Executive Director of Health Access. And Larry Levitt, I'd like to turn now to you, because one question that's come up repeatedly from the audience and was actually a question I had myself is, with all these new people coming into the system, we don't have enough primary care providers in California. How are we going to fill the need on the provider side with all these people who are trying to access a physician or primary care?
No, it's a good question. And first of all, it's important to remember these people, even if people are uninsured, they're not getting no care now. People are getting care. They're often just paying for it out of their own pockets, and they're not getting always the right care or enough care. But certainly there will be a greater need for medical professionals, whether that's physicians or physician assistants or nurses. And it's not just a raw numbers issue, but also a distribution issue. So making sure that we have the right kinds of doctors so that we're emphasizing primary care, but also getting them in the right place. In urban areas, there's typically not as much of a need as there is in rural areas. But there are some pieces of the law that do help. For example, in Medi-Cal in particular, the Medicaid program in California, the rates paid to doctors are extremely low. And those rates will be increased for primary care physicians up to what is paid for people on Medicare, for Medicare beneficiaries. So that should increase access quite a bit. But over time, we certainly do need to get more primary care physicians and professionals into the system. But that's not going to happen overnight. Medical school takes a few years to get through.
Bill Kramer, you look like you want to jump in here.
I was going to say we shouldn't just look at this as a numbers game. If we keep the way we're currently delivering care, yes, there's going to be a tremendous stress on the system. And if you just run the numbers, you say there's going to be an X percentage shortfall in the number of primary care physicians that are needed and specialists and so on. What this means, though, is that we have a need and an opportunity to redesign how care is being delivered. Let me just give one example. The Boeing company, a number of years ago, launched a pilot in the Seattle area. It's since been expanded to a few sites here in California, and under an innovation grant from the Affordable Care Act will be expanded to further sites for Medicare patients. We call it the Intensive Outpatient Care Program. It develops a care team to take care of people who are very, very sick, who have multiple chronic conditions. It is primary care based, but a key person there is a care manager, usually a nurse, who helps coordinate the care for these patients, and as a result of this, helps them avoid the avoidable hospital admissions, the avoidable repeat visits to the doctor. And as a result, we've seen not only tremendous savings, but also improvements in quality, improvements in the functional status of these patients, and the patients themselves say their care they're getting is better. We're doing this with less money, with a different mix of care providers, better care coordination. That's the kind of thing, if we can find ways to do it, will change the math and allow us to be able to provide care to more people in a better way with a different mix of our care providers.
Anthony Wright, are you concerned about, because you represent the people who will be most likely to be bearing the brunt of the access?
Well, I think there is no doubt that having coverage is a hell of a lot better than not having coverage, number one.
Well, health insurance is not health care either, so.
That's true, but I mean, there's some, I think people say that, but I do think coverage matters a lot. I mean, there was for folks who don't know, there was a study in Oregon where they had a Medicaid expansion, but they actually had to limit it, and so they did it by lottery. I'm hoping that we get away from the lottery-based healthcare system that we have now. But they had a lottery, and so it actually provided a perfect opportunity for researchers to take a look at what's the impact of Medicaid, which again is, you know, has been bad-mouthed and beleaguered by politicians in Washington and otherwise. And the results were astounding about the outcomes differences between those who were on Medicaid versus those who are left uninsured. I mean, there was real demonstrable health outcome differences, real demonstrated differences in financial security and other aspects. So coverage does matter a lot. That said, access is incredibly important. We have a problem with our Medicaid system that was talking about a pre-existing condition. It was, you know, existed before the passage of the Affordable Care Act. We still have to work on it. Part of that problem is the problem with our state budget, which there will be lots of opportunity to talk about, especially with an initiative on the ballot this November. But the point is that I think that, number one, you know, these folks are already in our healthcare system, but they're in our healthcare system in the least efficient, most expensive way possible. Number two, we do need to use and include our safety net providers in these new networks so that those providers can continue to provide services to this new population. We need all boots on the ground, all hands on deck, in terms of building the capacity of our health system to deal with it. And three, you know, we do need to both increase the capacity, and I would say one other challenge, which is it's not just more, it's also, we also need to reflect the diversity of our state, that the newly insured has a different demographic outlook in terms of communities of color, in terms of people who speak a range of languages than the population as a whole. And so this will create some a demand-driven change in our healthcare system to respond to that in terms of medical interpretation, in terms of getting a workforce in our healthcare system that looks like California as a whole.
So as I look through the questions, there's a lot of concern or skepticism from the audience about the funding, both the Medicaid expansion funding and how long the federal government will really provide that funding, and also the subsidies. I mean, so Peter Lee, are you? I mean, if the subsidies go away, or if they get reduced, I mean, yes, we have a budget crisis in the state. How can we add on millions more people in the public insurance system?
There's no question that California needs the federal support to expand coverage, without a doubt. The big question, though, is we're paying the bill already. We're paying the bill by people who have no coverage going to the emergency room, as Anthony noted, in the most expensive, least efficient way. And the reason I'm very confident that the subsidies are going to stay is I think they're going to show value. They're going to show value to the entire system by having people being kept healthier, having preventive care being delivered more effectively, having less stress on emergency rooms. But also, again, the 7 million Californians that don't have insurance want to have insurance. They want coverage. These are people that are going to be talking to their family members, talking to others. And this is why, you know, when we launched Medicare 50 years ago, it took a couple of years, but after a couple of years, people said, how could we not have this? We take it for granted that our seniors should absolutely have health care. I predict a couple of years after 2014, we're going to say, you look back to the ancient days of 2012, how could we, America, have had 7 million uninsured in the state of California? That's insane. Are you serious? And that's the place we think we're going to be and why we're going to have the subsidies in place. Just like we don't talk about, most of us, throwing out Medicare because it's expensive. We need to make it work. And the same thing, I think, will happen with the exchange and expanded coverage through the Affordable Care Act.
There's also we call them subsidies, but in fact they're tax credits that go to middle-class, middle-income families. And, yes, we've certainly shown a history of cutting back on assistance to the poor. But once a middle-class tax cut or tax break is in effect, that turns out to be pretty hard to take away. I mean, the mortgage tax deduction, which is pretty comparable to this, is here to stay for quite a while.
I would like to say two things about the impact on the state budget. It's important to recognize that the Affordable Care Act is actually providing $500 million a year of relief to our state budget already. So it is providing help to our state budget already. Number two, in terms of the federal level, I think people don't recognize that the way that the act was constructed, it was constructed to be paid for. And so the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office actually scores it as a deficit reduction act. In fact, one of the largest deficit reduction acts ever passed by Congress because of some of the reforms that it does to our health care system. So actually, when the Republicans who run the U.S. House of Representatives sought to repeal this act, they actually had to suspend the rules about deficit reduction in order to do that, in order to pass the bill without passing something in its place to pay for the repeal. So let me be clear. I do think that depending on what happens in the November election, the big question of the subsidies and whether the federal subsidies will come is entirely dependent on the November election. Because I just have to take the presidential candidate at his word that what he did in Massachusetts, he will undo for the America. But beyond that, I do think that it would be very hard to repeal it otherwise, because it actually is a cost savers in the long run.
I have to say, it wouldn't be, I'm going to pivot again, it wouldn't be a Bay Area discussion without a lot of questions from the audience, still harking back to single payer. And so, Larry Levitt, can you just address if we will have, there are some people who are saying they would like for the ACA to be overturned and for a single payer to be, or can a single payer be implemented alongside the Affordable Care Act? Can you just address the political realities of that?
Sure. Back up a second, too. I mean, we probably do more polling on healthcare than any other organization. And as I said, we found that the public is very split on this law. Interesting enough, when you look
on
at
the Affordable Care Act.
Interesting enough, when you look at the opponents fall into two camps. It's people who, let's say the Tea Party, we'll call them Tea Partiers, who are opposed because they think it's an overreach, that it's a bigger role for government than they want. But in fact, there's another group of opponents who think it doesn't go far enough in reforming the healthcare system. I don't think single payer is going to happen federally anytime soon. I don't think it's going to happen in California anytime soon either. But in fact, the Affordable Care Act does provide for states to have an option of doing that. I mean, this federal money we've been talking about, the federal money to expand Medicaid, and to go towards tax credits for middle-income families. If a state wants to try and do this in a different way, wants to try and cover people who are uninsured, they can take that federal money and use it in a different system. And, in fact, Vermont is looking to try and do that. So that option is certainly there for California if the politics change somewhat, but I don't see that happening anytime soon. And I would just also say that this this law, as controversial as it's been, it's actually a very moderate law. I mean, this is an approach. I mean, using competing private insurance companies, requiring employers to either provide insurance or pay a penalty of requiring people, individuals, to buy insurance if they can afford it, has historically been a very conservative Republican idea. In fact, it goes further than even what Nixon proposed back in the early 70s. So this is a very modest law. I don't think it's the end of our healthcare reform discussion. I mean, we talked earlier about costs. We're going to be coming back to this over and over and over again, whether you like it or not.
And Anthony Wright, Health Access.
There is a bill in the California legislature, SB 810, authored by State Senator Mark Leno of San Francisco. It is pending, but I will just simply say that Those who support it, and I include myself in that, among that list, it's on a different timetable. You know, the process to put that in place, especially the financing and everything else, would be on something like 2017, 2018 to get everything in place, to get the federal waivers, et cetera. And so this is, the Affordable Care Act provides real tools, real benefits, real funding, and, right now, and in the next 2 years to put in place. We need to work on that as well. I don't think that for those who support that vision, that it's contradictory to support that and do this. I don't think one necessarily leads to the other, but I do think that they're not contradictory either.
We've had also several questions from the audience. I'm going to read this one here and build on it myself. It's directed to you, Peter Lee, with the California Health Benefit Exchange. Is it true that the current pool of uninsured are the most expensive pool of people to provide health care to? And I would add, given that the tax penalty is relatively low, won't people who are healthy opt for the penalty as opposed to paying for health insurance, thus leaving the sickest to be in the plan? I know you've touched on this earlier, yeah, but it really gets at this. Will people really enroll?
Yeah. I think that, again, there's 5 million uninsured in California who will have access to new support to get health insurance, about 2 million Medi-Cal, the Medicaid program, and about 3 million through the exchange. Those 3 million are about the same as the rest of the state, and we've actually done looking at their health status. So our job is, as Anthony noted, to get every one of them in. Now, again, these people, and we've done focus groups of Spanish speakers, of English speakers, of Vietnamese speakers, of Cantonese speakers, which we need to do because we're a very diverse state. When you talk to people, what do they say? Heck yeah, I want to have insurance if it can be affordable. And so we will be doing a lot of outreach to make it clear why this is a good thing for them. And there's going to be rules, too. We'll be educating people saying, if you decide to not come in and buy insurance, it's not just the issue of you've got a small penalty. And it is a pretty small penalty. It's that if something happens to you and you decide to what we call go bare in the insurance world, your house is going to be at risk. You're going to be at risk for today's world and need to pay the entire bill. So part of our outreach and our education needs to be speaking to people in language they understand, and I mean that both culturally, the language they speak, but also speaking to people where they are, which is people want insurance. They want affordable coverage, and that's what we'll try to provide them.
Okay. There's also I'm wondering, Bill Cramer, if there's any concern, given in Massachusetts, where there is a statewide program and there's near universal coverage, they have seen a freeing up of people who've left their jobs, who are becoming more entrepreneurial. Is there any concern among big employers that they might actually lose people? Because people will be free to move around in a way they haven't. People will have portability in a way they haven't had before.
Well, I think business people generally support the idea that people should be mobile and people should be have the opportunity to be entrepreneurial. Right now, our system creates what the health policy wonks would call job lock, golden handcuffs, if you will. People who have good coverage may want to start up their own business, may want to go out and be their own, you know, king of their company or queen of their company. And they can't right now because they'll have a tough time getting health care coverage. Most businesses would support that. Now, on the other hand, they don't want people just running out the doors. That's why there's an incentive for large employers to continue to offer good coverage. Healthcare coverage is a really important element of recruiting and retaining talent. That's why large employers will continue to do that in the foreseeable future. But I think they're generally supportive of the idea that the Affordable Care Act will allow some of their employees who are stuck in their current jobs because of benefits, will allow them to go off, explore their dreams, and unleash an entrepreneurial spirit. That's better for business and the economy overall.
And what a better California thing, right? Following your dreams, whether it be on entrepreneurial dreams in Silicon Valley, or whether it's in the arts, you know, in the huge entertainment sector we have here in California. What a better way to encapsulate the California dream than to say you can go and you can get coverage regardless of the career path you choose.
So I have a question from the audience here. On January 1st, 2014, insurers can no longer discriminate against people with pre-existing conditions. That's actually already the case now. But it gets to this question of rating. Does this mean that two women, both 50 years old, one with breast cancer and one with a completely disease-free, who enjoys good health, would pay the same rates? So this is...
Yeah, and I would clarify, it's actually not the case now. Children cannot be discriminated against if they have a pre-existing health condition, or people who are getting coverage through an employer. But if people are buying coverage on their own, they certainly are and do. They can either be denied coverage or
there's
can be charged
the pre-existing
higher.
Pool now. There's
right.
a, there's already
right.
a pool for the people, yes.
But it certainly is true. I mean, if you look at two people, two women who are identical in every way, except one is sick, right now that woman who is sick probably could not get coverage at all or would be...
On the individual market. If she works for one of Bill Craver's large employers, she would be covered.
Absolutely. But come January 1st, 2014, they would be charged. They would both be guaranteed coverage and charged the same premium.
Okay.
And that goes to a point of the work that we still will need to do both in this interim period and in 2014 to continue to stay vigilant and implement this law to react to what's going on in the marketplace. So, you know, the Affordable Care Act does say no longer should children be allowed to be denied for pre-existing conditions immediately. And then for adults and everybody else kick in 2014. When some of the insurers said, well, wait a minute, if we have to cover sick kids, then we don't want to cover kids at all. And they started withdrawing child-only policies from the marketplace. But what it did is it took passing laws here in California reacting to that to say, well, if you don't cover kids, you don't get to cover adults either. That they all came back into the marketplace very quickly. That's an example where we need to be vigilant to make sure that to the extent that there are opportunities for loopholes, we can close them quickly and effectively. And that's why you need the Affordable Care Act is not self-implementing. It's not something that will it provides tools, it provides a framework, it provides financing, but it really does take the work of policymakers and leaders and stakeholders on the ground here in California in order to make it work, in order to make reform real for Californians.
Peter Lee with the, oh, go ahead, please.
Well, I just wanted, Anthony said about stakeholders here in California, and I spent 2 years in Washington before coming back home to California. I just want to note that one of the things that has been so powerful is I've been across the state. I've been in San Diego, Redding, Fresno, Riverside. I've not had people throwing tomatoes or brickbats at the exchange. I've had thousands of people saying, how do we make this thing work? And it's been so refreshing to see this state say, this isn't a political football that we're going to toss around. Rather, we're going to try to make sure we have a healthcare system that works for everyone. And I think that's one of the reasons that I'm very confident we will, is we have a state that has brought together doctors, nurses, consumer advocates, agents, representatives of health plans, hospitals, saying, this is something we have to do, and it's not going to work if we make it a political game. We can't afford to make it a game. And I think we've seen that happen in the state of California.
Along those lines, I have a question from the audience. If the federal law is repealed, will California continue on its own?
I mean, I've got to say this, Peter, again, that there is no way in the world this law is going to be repealed, no matter who's elected president, is that this is already baked in many ways. There may be changes to it. I mean, you look at, as Anthony noted, right now there are tens of millions of Medicare beneficiaries who are paying less for prescription drugs because of the Affordable Care Act. You think a new president even is going to say, let's take away those benefits from 25 million Medicare beneficiaries? I don't think so. So we may have changes to the Affordable Care Act, and there's things we can improve, but it's not going to be repealed outright. We need to make sure it's built on, it's improved, and I think we can do that.
I'll
does
just
anyone?
Go to Peter a little bit.
I mean, okay. Larry Levitt, Kaiser Family Foundation.
It might not be repealed outright. Certain elements might continue, but it could certainly be gutted. With I mean, the November election is very much a turning point here. I mean, you have a president running on his legacy of this law, and his opponent who's running on the platform of either repealing it largely scaling it back. And as I said, the country is split, and I think the election will very much determine the future of this law.
And so we also have some questions, and I've been wondering this myself too. If we have states that do not participate in the Medicaid expansion, could California become a magnet for surrounding states that aren't? Oh, Anthony Wright, you really scrunched up your eyes and looked horrified. You really don't like this question.
California is a magnet for all sorts of good reasons. So we're a magnet because of our sunshine, because of our weather, because of what we are. I don't think there's any evidence of that. I do think that we actually have a unique role in this national debate. We are, again, we have one of the worst indicators in terms of the scale of the problem here in California. And if you look at like the top 10 states, top 12 states in terms of those with the worst uninsured rate, California is the only one that's really going ahead and maximizing the benefit. And we're leading every state, all 50 states. But we're especially important because we're somebody with a 20% uninsured rate with all these issues who's actually taking advantage of the solutions in the Affordable Care Act that go to directly address these issues. And so we can be the beacon to say, hey, look, we can do it. The other states that have done it, Massachusetts started with a 10% uninsured rate before they had their reform, and then they got it down to 2%, which is best in the nation and good for them. But, you know, we have more uninsured than Massachusetts has people. as Peter and I were discussing earlier, it's a one baseball state, a baseball team state. I mean, So we have an example just by our scale, not just a scale of our size, but the scale of our problem to say this is how it works, and hopefully we can get citizens in other states to say, why are the folks in California getting all the benefits? Why can't we too?
Okay. Bill Kramer, Pacific Business Group on Health.
Just wanted to reinforce the idea that California can be and is already a beacon, is a bellwether for the other states, not only in how its state implements the elements of the Affordable Care Act, but in the way that our healthcare delivery system is already changing and is on the vanguard. The organization of medical groups, the development of coordinated care between hospital systems and medical groups, some of the progressive health plans in the states. We can show how, not only how we can cover more people, how we can develop a very effective exchange, but also how we can transform how care is provided and ways that we can provide higher quality and more affordable care. As I go around the country, talk to people, they look to California as a bellwether for those kind of innovations. If we can find a way to spread those innovations to other parts of the country, then we have a shot nationwide at addressing this problem of quality and cost.
Then we had, we're coming to the point where we just have time for one last question. And one thing that will happen that we haven't really touched on is there will be a flow of a lot of money into this state. And Larry Levitt from the Kaiser Family Foundation, how much of an effect is that going to have on jobs in California?
Well,
on healthcare jobs.
No, it's certainly. And, this is a big issue in this question of whether states take up this Medicaid expansion or not, which California has decided to do. I mean, this is money coming from the federal government into a state. It's not money that the state has to decide whether to raise. So it's a net inflow of federal dollars that could certainly have a large effect on jobs. And, it's not just the healthcare jobs. Macroeconomists talk about the multiplier effect. It's those healthcare jobs, and then those the fact that healthcare is more affordable. People have more money in their pockets. They go out and buy more things. So it's small business jobs. It really flows throughout the economy, and we're talking about quite a bit of money. I mean, in the many billions of dollars.
And Bill Kramer, how do large employers then react to the Affordable Care Act and the money coming in?
Well, I think that there are a number of aspects to it. Well, one is for large employers who are in the healthcare business, this is a tremendous opportunity, whether you're a hospital system, a medical group, a drug company, a medical device manufacturer, their insurance company. There's both challenges but tremendous opportunities because of the Affordable Care Act. What other employers, purchasers, want to see, though, is this money is being put to good use. There's a lot of ways to spend money in healthcare. We want to make sure it's being used to really not only improve access, but also improve quality and be able to find ways to reward more efficient care.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, and this has been the Commonwealth Club and a discussion about the Supreme Court's decision on the Affordable Care Act. I'd like to thank our panelists, Peter Lee, the Executive Director of the California Health Benefit Exchange, Larry Levitt, from Vice President of Special Projects at the Kaiser Family Foundation, Bill Kramer, Executive Director for National Health Policy at the Pacific Business Group on Health, and Anthony Wright, Executive Director of Health Access. We also thank our audience here and on the radio. This program has been underwritten by the California Healthcare Foundation. I'm Lisa Alaferis, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Well gathered.